This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zind in for Jane Lindholm. You might be surprised at what's being manufactured in Vermont. Tucked away, out of sight of most of us, there are companies making all sorts of things. Some are locally owned, others part of big global enterprises. All have had to adjust to change. Advances in technology and the decline in the number of manufacturing jobs have made it challenging for them to find skilled workers. That's been the case at a manufacturing plant in Williston, owned by a Canadian company called Velan. Dennis Lalancet is plant manager.
We make industrial valves, not something you're going to find in a hardware store, but the things we make are for industrial applications. There used to be a lot of machinists that were out there in the marketplace, but over years, you know, we talked about in general terms a downturn in training opportunities and opportunities for people to get into the technical manufacturing field, combined with the aging population of skilled tradesmen. It's really made it difficult to get the kind of skilled labor that we need.
There's 150 people in Williston, but the majority of Vermont's 1,000-plus manufacturing firms actually have fewer than 10 employees. And for many of them, finding qualified workers is a big issue, something that's not unique to Vermont. Today, we'll talk about that and other challenges manufacturers face. We'll get a sense of what makes the growing ones successful and what the state is doing and can do to help them. We'd like to hear from you, too. Only about 10% of Vermont jobs these days are in manufacturing. So how important do you think the sector is to the state's economy? If you run a manufacturing firm, tell us about the upside and downside of doing business in Vermont. If you're a past or present employee of a manufacturer, we'd like to hear about the rewards or frustrations of the work. You can email us at vermontedition@vpr.net, or better yet, call us at 1-800-639-2211. We're going to talk to some Vermont manufacturers today, but let's begin with an overview of the industry, and here to help us out with that is Lisa Gosselin, who's Commissioner of the Department of Economic Development. Thanks for coming in today, Lisa.
Thank you, Steve.
So we do talk about the growth of manufacturing. I think many people think its heyday is come and gone and that's the end of it. But manufacturers, I think, are the first to tell you that that's not the case and that in many cases there's some growth. Is there any way to quantify or characterize what we're seeing in terms of trends among manufacturers in Vermont?
Well, I think Vermont has always been sort of the birthplace of manufacturing. And I think if you think of all the innovations that went on in Springfield in the 1800s, it was really where manufacturing is born. It was where things like the American system of manufacturing that used division of labor, mechanized production, new business systems of networks that paired engineers, entrepreneurs, craftsmen, and mechanics started out. Yet I think today we think of that old system of manufacturing. We think of smokestacks. We think of assembly lines. And that's not where manufacturing is going. Increasingly what we're seeing are very, very innovative, very highly specialized, very, very precise systems that rely on highly skilled labor, very technical instrumentation, and a lot of software.
We mentioned that some of these manufacturers in Vermont are branches of big global firms. Others are right here in Vermont, owned and operated here in Vermont. Are most of them sort of indigenous manufacturing operations, or are most of them parts of larger wholes?
What we see increasingly is that there are a number of Vermont manufacturers that have started here, have grown up here, and frankly are expanding, and that's very exciting. I look at Mack Molding, which is based in Arlington, also has a plant in Cavendish. It is one of our largest manufacturers and frankly one of our largest private sector employers in the state. And they have done an amazing job in building different parts for other companies, everything from the they create a milkshake machine that sells for $5,000, and you can see that now in a lot of the rest stops around the country. They are making things that are taser testers. Mm-hmm. They have built a solar powered lamppost that is very innovative and very creative.
Do you, when you look at all the manufacturers, I mean, there's such a variety, but I wonder, are there any commonalities to those that seem to be succeeding?
I think it really comes down to innovation. The ones who are succeeding have really found, number one, a very strong niche, and I think a Vermont Precision Tool up in the Swanton, St. Albans area. And what they are doing is really creating very tiny measurement systems mm-hmm. that other people are using. And I think that's one of the keys. You know, we're doing a lot of parts for airlines. We don't make airplanes themselves, but we make a lot of the parts that airplanes use.
And that's been my impression, that maybe there was a day when more Vermont manufacturers were mass producing items, and that the ones I've seen that seem to be doing well have found a little niche. They're not necessarily, you know, making a lot of off-the-shelf items. They're making prototypes. They're making specialty products. And that seems to be that kind of niche that they found, rather than competing with larger companies, say, that are making, you know, millions of widgets or something.
That's true. And I think I look at also what GW Plastics has done. They started out doing a lot of automotive parts. And I think they've been very nimble and very smart and creative in looking at what are the new opportunities. And they've now moved into medical devices and are very successful in what they're doing there.
Let's say, I want to get into manufacturing. I have an idea. Maybe I've got a small operation going. I come to the state. What are you going to do for me?
Well, there are a number of things. I think, number one, we're seeing the emergence of new maker spaces, such as the Generator Lab in Burlington, where if you have an idea for a product, thanks to 3D printing, you can now go in and actually fabricate that product. We're working very closely with operations such as Launch Vermont to try to encourage new startups to think about what the potential is. And there are also a number of programs and incentives that will help emerging businesses grow.
We're talking to Lisa Goslin, who's the Commissioner of the Department of Economic Development. Manufacturing is the focus of today's Vermont Edition program. We'd like to hear from you at 1-800-639-2211. And we'll be talking, as I mentioned, to a couple of people involved in manufacturing, including Dixie Zenz, who's Vice President of Abacus Automation in Bennington. Dixie, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So just give us a sense of what Abacus does, and maybe a specific example of a product that Abacus makes that we might or might not be familiar with.
We design and build custom automation equipment for all different manufacturers all around the world. Some of the things we've done, we've glued the wicks and jars for Yankee Candle. We do some chopping for the Berry Calibou, which is up in northern Vermont, and it cuts the chocolate into little pieces. Ben and Jerry's uses their chocolate in their ice cream. We've built lots and lots of different systems. So we've built the an assembly system that puts together fuel cells, and these fuel cells are used right now in the Freedom Towers down in New York City. So it's a huge variety of things that we do. If you can't go out and buy it, we'll design and build it. That's what we do.
All right. And Dixie, you employ about 40 people down there?
You're 35 right now, yes.
Okay. And give us a sense of, you know, what sort of growth track, if any, your company's on.
Well, during the recession, we were down to 20, and we've built ourselves back up to 35, and that's a pretty good number. We probably will stay around 40 to under 50 as we continue to regain our momentum here. Things are looking good. The recession, we survived it well, and now that we're on an upward trend, it seems like the economy is in gear. It's not a huge climb, but it's definitely going uphill, which is...
So what would you say that your biggest challenges are now at Abacus Automation?
Part of it is recruiting folks to work with us. All our people have to be technically competent, and workforce development's a big interest for us, and we are working with our local development companies and education folks down here to try to get our workforce educated so that they can get these good jobs that we offer and other folks in this area offer also.
Do you do a lot of your own training at this point?
We do. We have some folks that started right at the Career Development Center, which is our technical school here in Bennington, and they are now engineers paid that way, and I'd put them up against any engineers anywhere as far as the software they develop and the designs that they do. It's really
so,
great.
So, you know, if you can be specific about what kind of skills you're looking for in workers and how much post-secondary education is involved in acquiring those skills.
You know, we have some great engineers that have four-year degrees that are terrific, and we don't have a definite requirement. If someone has the right attitude, I think we'll train them, and they do need the skills of math and science and have an interest in being able to solve problems, which, you know, basically all jobs require problem solving. But I think one of the interests that our folks have here is that everything is new and different, so it's always a challenge to for the next project that comes along. So.
I mean, when you say math and science, we would assume that anybody coming out of, let's say, a two-year college would have math and science skills. You're not finding that's the case?
We find it difficult that to find folks in this area down in southern Vermont, that the young folks that have those skills, that want to be in this area. Now, maybe they're going other places. I know that Vermont has an issue with younger folks leaving. I have two older kids that are living outside of Vermont, and I wish they were back here, but it's something that I think the state, and I know our town, is working on. We have a young professionals group trying to encourage younger folks to have activities that will keep them interested in this area. But that's it's an important piece to keep the young folks here.
And can you give us a sense of the relative age of your workforce? Do you have older workers that you're going to need to replace as they retire?
We have had a few that have retired, and we have replaced them. Right now, we're fairly young. I would say probably average age is about 40 right now. So we have a pretty good workforce at this point.
All right. Well, Dixie, thanks for talking with us today.
Well, thank you, and you have a great day.
Thanks. Dixie Zenz is Vice President of Abacus Automation in Bennington. Lisa Goslin, Commissioner of the Department of Economic Development, I think that refrain about trained workers, in young workers coming in, is something you must hear every time you talk to manufacturers.
Absolutely, Steve. We hear two things. One, that manufacturers really value the current Vermont workforce. I think we have a long tradition of craftsmanship and of precision. And what we hear, even from manufacturers who have plants elsewhere, is the Vermont workforce is unparalleled. There are really a lot of very careful, very dedicated people. We also hear, though, that there is a need to bring new people on. And I think that's an increasing challenge, and it's one that we are trying to address in a number of different ways. We have the Vermont Training Program, which looks at really supplementing the cost of training. We provide up to 50% of the cost of training for qualified companies and individuals. And those can be incumbent employees or new employees who are going to be moving into a job and need the skills to do it.
Do you think the issue is we don't have enough programs or the right programs in place to satisfy employers' needs, or there just simply aren't enough young people who are entering those programs?
I think it's threefold. I think first and foremost, frankly, it's that the pace of learning, the pace of change has increased. You can no longer just come out of school and learn something and step into, say, operating a machine shop and use the same tools and the same knowledge over 5 years. Things are changing really quickly. So there's a need for ongoing learning. I think that we do have a challenge in terms of the number of people we have coming into the workforce, and that's something we're trying to address. And we're also working very closely with educational institutions such as Vermont Tech to try to create a better stream of people of very, very specific skills that are going to be able to be used in jobs that are here in Vermont.
Talking about manufacturing in Vermont on Vermont Edition today and taking your calls, let's talk to Rachel in Winooski. Hi, Rachel. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thank you. So I work at Vermont Works for Women, and I wanted to bring the gender lens to the conversation. So mostly just a small comment that one of our areas of focus is on offering training in non-traditional fields for women, and manufacturing and machining would be one of those. So just in the same spirit of what the panelists have been talking about in terms of making the most of our homegrown talent, I think we need to put an effort into diversifying the current workforce and you know, if women are working, women are more likely to live in poverty than working men, and so given that machining and manufacturing are very much livable wage jobs, I think the state needs to put an increased focus on STEM equity or STEM education for girls in our high schools and our tech schools, as well as training opportunities for women. And of course, I just wanted to put in a small plug that we will be offering a training for women specifically in skilled manufacturing in Brattleboro coming up in the new year.
All right. Thanks, Rachel. Appreciate you bringing up that point. Lisa Goslin.
That's a great point, Rachel, and we see that there are increasing opportunities for women pretty much in all aspects of the workforce. Our Vermont Strong Scholars Program is really looking at how can we incent high school students, both men and women, to pursue careers that are really focused on where the jobs are, particularly in STEM. I think also our universal pre-K education bill, which will basically provide education for young kids, will free up more women to rejoin the workplace after they've had children. And I think that's a very, very important workforce for us.
You know, Rachel's sentiments were echoed by an email we got from Professor Dave Jarmie at Vermont Technical College, who wrote us before the program. And he says, I've taught electronic, electromechanical programming subjects for 35 years at VTC, and during the time I only once had two female students in a class. Usually there are none. In addition, incoming class sizes have shrunk to low double digits. After completion of a two-year associate's degree in this field, the starting salary is typically a minimum of $35,000, and we have more job postings than we do candidates. And he finishes his email by suggesting that high school guidance counselors be encouraged to try to round up 60 female applicants and start them next fall at VTC. He writes, you don't need to be big, brawny, or male to have smarts in this arena. So that speaks to the two issues, the gender divide, but also maybe this idea that they're just young. This isn't sort of on the radar screen for a lot of young people when they're thinking about their job futures.
Well, I think part of it's also communications, that many people may be still thinking of manufacturing as, the dirty old, factories. It's not. It's very creative. It's very challenging. These are very high-wage jobs often that do require lots of skill, lots of precision. One thing we are working on at the statewide level is to better communicate what jobs are available and connect both current Vermonters and perhaps people who grew up in Vermont and may have left to go to college or to pursue a career elsewhere to come back. And we are working with HR directors around the state to post those jobs both on the Department of Labor job site and on a LinkedIn site that's called Great Jobs in Vermont.
There was a tech summit a couple of months ago at the State House. You were probably there, Lisa. But one of the interesting observations made by people who were involved in the technology field was they felt Vermont was marketing itself in a way that was almost counterproductive for what they wanted to accomplish, which was to present Vermont as a tech center and a friendly environment for tech companies. They felt that there was just too much emphasis on Vermont's pastoral qualities, and that it gave the impression that, gee, there's nothing but farms and cows and, I'm not going to be able to get online, or the infrastructure isn't available to us. I mean, did they have a point?
I think that a brand is built over many, many years. And I think historically that has been part of the brand that most visitors are aware of. And frankly, that's the brand that tourism markets, as well it should. Tourism is not in charge of marketing, businesses or technology. What we are trying to do, though, is change that perception. And at the Department of Economic Development, we just came out with a list of 100 innovations made in Vermont. This is a list. We did 50 innovations last year. We built it onto 100 this year.
Think
we have
of
a great
any examples
slideshow
for us.
Oh, we have things like what Dixie's doing down in there. I mentioned Mac molding solar powered lamp posts. Liquid Measurement Systems does actually measurement for fuel systems. What are some of the Stave Puzzles in Wilder creates these incredibly intricate puzzles. Mm-hmm. And we think of manufacturing in a lot of different ways. Manufacturing is also what King Arthur Flour is doing. It's also what Keurig Green Mountain is doing. So there are a lot of different things that require manufacturing skills but may not be what you think of in terms of manufacturing.
Well, today we are surveying the manufacturing landscape in Vermont and asking you if you think there's a brighter future for manufacturing and what it would take to get there. Join the conversation at 1-800-639-2211 or email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zinden for Jane Lindholm. Vermont manufacturing is all about technical skills these days. Machines are computer programmed and workers need a different set of skills than in the past. As we've heard, finding people with those skills can be a challenge. That seems to be one of the biggest hurdles manufacturers face. So what are the solutions and what would it take to grow more manufacturing jobs in Vermont? We'd like to hear from you at 1-800-639-2211 or email vermontedition@vpr.net. We're joined in the studio by Lisa Goslin, who's the commissioner of the Department of Economic Development, and we're talking to some folks involved in the manufacturing industry, among them Jim Sharkey, who's vice president and general manager of Kemen Composites, which is also in Bennington. They do manufacturing for aerospace and the medical industries and employ about 175 people. Welcome to the program, Jim.
Yes, hello. Thanks for having me on.
I wonder, just so we get a clear idea of what's going on there, can you give us an example or two of something that's being made that we might be familiar with or might not?
Yes, certainly. We manufacture a range of products here for the aerospace industry and the medical industry. We manufacture lightweight products for aircraft from carbon fiber reinforced plastics. But for the medical industry, we make patient supports, tabletops, which are used in imaging machines. If you've ever had a CAT scan or a CT scan, the chances are you were probably lying on one of the tables that we made here in Bennington. Mm-hmm. They're made from carbon fiber because it's very strong and able to support the patient. And also the low density of the material makes them relatively transparent to x-rays. So the image is taken by passing an x-ray through the patient through the table to a detector, so the more transparent the table is, the lower dose of x-rays that have to be given to the patient.
Is there much competition in what you do?
There is, yeah. There's competition worldwide. We are one of the biggest players in that particular field, which is one of the niches that we have developed over the years, and it was in fact the product range that founded the company here in Bennington 35 years ago.
And so when you're talking about global competition, are you at an advantage being in Vermont, a disadvantage? If so,
I don't think we're at a disadvantage. We make relatively small volumes of high-value product. Mm-hmm. So our location is not that critical in terms of having high shipping costs or logistic costs. So location is not so important to us as with other businesses or in other industries. And I say we ship everywhere from China to India, Europe, and all across America.
We mentioned you have 175 employees there in Bennington. What are the prospects for growth, or is that a pretty comfortable number that you think you'll stay at?
No, I was looking at some numbers the other day, and the company has probably grown about an 8% average annual rate almost since it was founded. Obviously, there have been ups and downs during that process, but the average growth has been round about that range, and we expect to see that continue.
You typically have openings there?
We do, yeah. Again, it depends on the product's life cycle of our various products. We have one or two openings at the moment. Sometimes we have more, but usually we have at least one or two at any one time just to cope with the mm-hmm. natural turnover of staff that any business would have.
And, you know, when you do have an opening, do you get a good response in terms of number of applicants? And then as you go through those applicants, what's your sense of how many are well qualified for the job?
It depends on the type of positions. We are a very engineering-dependent business here. Again, listening to Dixie Zenz earlier, you know, we're looking for problem solvers here. Mm-hmm. We employ a lot of engineers. We work closely with the high school and the Career Development Center here in Bennington. Usually we have one intern from the Career Development Center who's taking the engineering class there who would work with us for a few hours a week. During the holidays or during the summer, we usually have undergraduate students from local colleges and universities here, again, working as interns.
So it sounds like you're collaborating with some local institutions to get trained workers.
We are, in some ways more formally than others. Local institutions here tend to be over in nearby New York, Hudson Valley Community College and Rensselaer Polytechnic, places like that. Also UVM, though. And many of these people have gone on, having worked with us as interns for several years during their college life.
Well, could more
some
be
of them are working for us now?
Could more be done either by the state on a statewide basis or with local partners to help you out in that
well,
area?
Well, one thing that I think has been quite successful, a couple of years ago, we were part of a pilot program to introduce an apprenticeship in composites. So people would come out of the apprenticeship program as Vermont State recognized composites technicians. And we ran four of our employees through that program over the last two or three years. It involves 4,000 hours of on-the-job training over roughly a two-year period. So people would circulate through the various departments in the organization, learning the skills in each department. And then on top of that, they do just under 300 hours of classroom time, which would be at night school. And that was arranged through the Career Development Center here in Bennington, and it was partially funded. The program was partially funded by the state. That program was a pilot. I say I would like to see that moving forward. The people who went through the program were existing employees, but I think there's a good position for taking young people out of high school and starting on a program like that. People who may not be ready to go to college, may not want to go to college, perhaps can't afford to go to college, but could spend 2 years and get a formal qualification and work experience, be paid while they're doing it, and then consider college, you know, later on once they're in a better position to take on that responsibility. And also if they're working with us, we have tuition reimbursement schemes, et cetera.
All right. Great suggestion, Jim. We'll follow up with Lisa Goslin on that. Thanks for talking to us. Jim, is it Kaman Composites?
Kaman
Composites. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Okay. You're welcome.
Jim Sharkey's company is in Bennington and, as I said, employs about 175 people. So Jim seemed to identify kind of a gap there that might be filled by the state, Lisa, in terms of bringing prospective employees into training and programs.
Well, I think that's part of what we're trying to do with the Vermont Strong Scholars Program, where we're trying to create incentive for both high school students, associate's degrees, and obviously bachelor degree students to pursue a certain area of study. We're also working on an internship and an apprentice program, and I think we're trying to really work very closely with the career and technical colleges to create a better matchup so that people can use things like the Vermont Training Program, resources, and funding to bring both new employees and current employee skills up to the areas where they need.
Our number as we talk about Vermont manufacturing on Vermont Edition today is 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk with John, who's calling us from Richmond. Hi, John.
Hello. Hi. Part of my question might have been addressed by your previous guest, Mr. Sharkey, but my question was, seems to be the state is doing a fair amount with post-secondary, you know, technical colleges, and I'm just wondering what better preparation, collaboration, improvements could we be doing, you know, K through 12? So because we've got regional technical centers and we've got tons of conventional college prep, that they seem to be kind of separate and distinct. I'm just wondering if there's a way that we can improve the existing educational system so we're preparing kids better and they have more options, and then local manufacturers wouldn't have to look as far, at least for part of their workforce. I was just wondering what if any thought has been pushing it down into the secondary
school. All right. Thank you, John. You know, and I think he hits maybe tangentially on something that some people wonder about. They go, well, we've got these tech centers throughout the state at the high school level, aren't they able to prepare people to step right into these jobs?
Absolutely. And John Fisher's Deputy Secretary of Education has been working on a career and technical education readiness program that addresses just that. We're also really trying to do a better connection of exposing our current high school and even younger students to what are the career opportunities around them. And for the past couple of years, we've been having sort of an open house for manufacturers in October on National Manufacturing Day that's a little bit similar to the Open Studios Artist Weekends, where we're encouraging schools to actually bring students into some of their local manufacturers and to see what jobs are available. I might also add, too, that there are many more manufacturing jobs that are not what you traditionally think of. Many of these larger companies need sales. They need marketing. They need creative. They need a web developer. So it's not just engineering. It's not just math skills that are needed.
Let's talk for a minute with Jeff Higgins, who is the Director of External Programs at Vermont Technical College. Jeff works with a number of manufacturers on training programs for their employees. And, of course, he's also familiar with the types of programs offered for students at VTC. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi. Good to be with you.
So explain how VTC kind of connects with employees. How do VTC's resources come into play when you're working with employers on better training their workers?
Sure. Well, we really have two pathways that we help the Vermont manufacturer with their workforce. The first is the traditional student who comes here for an engineering degree in either mechanical engineering technology or electrical engineering technology. And last year we had 89 graduates, and they were virtually all snapped up by manufacturers before graduation. In fact, we probably could have placed well over 100 graduates in engineering technology if we had had that many students.
And Jeff, did they go to Vermont manufacturers or all over the place?
Mostly Vermont manufacturers. Okay. About 75% to 80% of our graduates stay in Vermont.
Okay.
But we just simply didn't have enough raw material, if you would, to produce enough graduates to meet all of the workforce needs for manufacturers. So the other avenue where we are working with them is through apprentice programs, just like Jim Sharkey talked about. GE Aviation, GS Precision down in Brattleboro, GW Plastics, to name a few. What they're doing is they're hiring apprentices, and they are taking them through on-the-job training, and then we are providing either mechanical engineering or electrical engineering education to those apprentices, either on-site at the manufacturer or nearby. So in that case, you know, it's a win-win in that the employee now has a high-pay, career-focused occupation, and they're getting an education that they wouldn't normally be able to get. And the manufacturers getting their workforce needs somewhat met.
So this is something that's done on the dime of the manufacturer.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And this involves people who are already working for the manufacturer, not people who are students at VTC, full-time students.
Well, they're working for the manufacturer as apprentices, so they're actually hiring people to become apprentices. So it's not like they have current workers who they're putting through the program.
Are they hiring them while they're VTC students, essentially?
No, they become VTC students as apprentices.
Gotcha. You know, it's been interesting to hear about, we've got programs that we have in place and we're developing, but there's also, it sounds as though there's really more to be done in terms of interesting people in participating in those programs, sort of making young people aware of what's out there for manufacturing jobs.
Absolutely. Like I said, we probably could have placed well over 100 graduates this past year, and we only had 89. And we have a pretty good retention rate. So once they come here, they are likely to graduate, and they are high-paying jobs in very exciting areas with great career potential. So our challenge is how do we get high school students interested in engineering education? I think we have about 3,000 high school grads in Vermont every year who don't go on to college. And so Vermont does a great job of graduating its high school students, but we're not doing that great a job of having them go on to post-secondary education in areas like engineering.
I don't know if you heard the email we read from Dave Jarmy, who's a professor at VTC. That's pretty much reflects what you've seen too, would you say, the lack of women pursuing these trades?
That would be an excellent way to try to meet this gap if we got more women involved, more girls involved in math and science and thinking about engineering as a career and then getting them as women to come to Vermont Technical College. There are just so many different avenues that we need to be able to take to try to boost enrollment in these areas so that we can meet the manufacturing workforce needs.
Do you think that the lack of interest or lack of numbers is a result of we're not doing a good enough job marketing and making people aware? Or are young people just not that interested in manufacturing jobs?
Well, I think there's two things. I think Lisa is correct in that there is sort of a myth about what manufacturing is like. What we need to do is try to get some of these students in maybe 8th or 9th grade to go into a GW Plastics and see really how cool the manufacturing line is with robotic arms and all the different technology that they use there. I think the other thing is that there may be some fear about cost of post-secondary education. And so one thing that we are trying to implement is what we call a VTech program, where a high school senior can take both their senior year of high school and their first year of an engineering curriculum at Vermont Technical College through dual enrollment. That would be paid for by the block grant because they would be a high school student. Mm-hmm. And then we'd like them to do an internship with a manufacturer during that summer, and then the manufacturer would provide a scholarship in the second year for that student. And then when that student graduates, they probably would be hired by that same manufacturer. So you're looking at a two-year education that ultimately may cost $5,000.
Jeff Higgins,
a great job.
Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Jeff Higgins is Director of External Programs at Vermont Technical College. Lisa Goslin, we have just a minute left, but it sounds like there are a lot of ideas out there for advancing the idea of providing more manufacturing jobs in Vermont.
I think there are currently many, many manufacturers who are expanding. I mean, if you think of IBM is hiring, Darn Tough is hiring, Mack Molding is hiring, and our goal is to try to provide a steady flow of students and postgrad people who can go and work
there. It seems like a critical thing if we want to bring more manufacturers and grow more manufacturers in Vermont that start with a workforce that's qualified and large enough to satisfy their needs.
Absolutely. And we also have a lot of other programs that will help grow. And we also are seeing energy rates come down. We're one of the few states that's actually dropping energy rates right now.
Lisa Goslin, Commissioner of Department of Economic Development, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Steve.
In a moment, Jane Lindholm gets a close-up view of, believe it or not, the ticks that biologists are counting as they track the health of the state's moose herd. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zinn, in for Jane Lindholm. Hunters took 169 moose during Vermont's archery and rifle seasons last month, according to the Fish and Wildlife Department. And whenever a moose is taken, a hunter is required to take it to one of the reporting stations around the state. There, biologists can document some information that will help them better understand the population. It also helps Fish and Wildlife determine how many moose permits to award the following year. So about halfway through the rifle season this year, Vermont Edition host Jane Lindholm stopped by the reporting station in the town garage in Middlesex. And there, Jane Lazarchuk, a wildlife biologist, was about to check her sixth moose of the day.
So tell me what's happening here.
All the hunters need to report the moose at biological check stations, and we're going to collect some data on the moose and try to figure out some information about the herd as a result. Did you guys take the moose today?
Yep.
Who's the lucky hunter? What's your name?
Jim Jewell.
Where are you from?
Moncton, Vermont.
So where'd you get this one?
Lincoln, Spruce Lodge. You
need to see the tag. Jewell and five other hunters used a horse to drag this female moose out of the woods. Lazorchek took Jewell's tag and permit and marked the numbers down on a sheet of paper. She asked the hunters a lot of questions. Rifle? What gauge? Was the moose lactating? Did they collect the ovaries? That's a requirement.
We're taking the ovaries in order to be able to tell how many calves she's had. So essentially be able to derive their reproductive rate. The reproductive rate went down for a number of years on moose, and the theory was that the habitat wasn't very good anymore. So they brought down the number of moose, thinking that over time, that if you brought the population down, the reproductive rate would come back up. But unfortunately, it hasn't come back up. And so now there's all these theories with ticks and other things that are affecting the moose. For a while, they were having two calves per year.
The next step is one that squeamish people, even some hunters, might find hard to listen to. Lazorchek removes a tooth from the moose's jaw. This is done to find out how old the moose is.
We've had multiple hunters leave this area while I do this because they can't handle the sound. They can handle shooting the moose and dragging it out, but they can't listen to the tooth being taken out.
Can you tell us today how old you think
I can't, but you can call.
Yeah.
So they lay down rings inside the root of their tooth just like a tree lays down rings.
Yep.
And so they do a cross-section. And
for the past 2 years, biologists have also been counting ticks on moose that come into the reporting station. In some parts of the country, including Vermont, ticks are blamed for the deaths of many moose and may be contributing to a reduction in the population here. Scientists are counting ticks on the moose that are brought in to try to establish how much of an issue they really are.
So tell me what you're doing here.
We're going to look at the animal in four spots, take four samples on the neck, the shoulder, the rib, and the rump, and we're going to look in 10 by 10 centimeter quadrants and part the hair four times to look for live nymphs and adult ticks. And in general, this time of year, they really only have the nymph stage, but I have seen some adults today, and we want to know if there's adults on them also. So you can see their mane is very thick. It's almost impossible to get down to the skin sometimes. Okay. So we're going to part four times. Okay, so you can see there's one, that yellow. I only see one.
It's hard to spot the ticks. They're small, really small, especially the nymphs. Adults are slightly larger.
So there's an actual adult. You can see that the adults are quite a bit different. Big, engorged.
It's kind of more sesame seed-like.
Yes, if you want to equate them to food. I try not to.
Lazorchek only found about a dozen ticks total during this tick check. That was a little bit surprising because the hair on the top of the moose had been rubbed off, as if the moose had been scratching herself. Jewel and the other hunters said her skin was like that when they shot her. It wasn't from being dragged out of the woods. When moose have a lot of ticks, they often do scratch at them, and the loss of fur makes them vulnerable to the cold. Sometimes moose can have tens of thousands of ticks on them by the end of winter.
That moose had only a couple of ticks on her. Is that typical for what you're finding?
Yes. Of all the moose I checked in today, just roughly six, only one of them had a lot of ticks. And actually, that one was really unusual because it was actually dead for almost 24 hours. So for it to actually still have a lot of ticks on it actually means it must have had quite a lot of ticks on it when it was actually killed. So typically, most of the ticks fall off within a short period of time after the animal's been killed because there's not blood circulating anymore for them to eat. But that one only had a few on it, and hopefully that's what we'll keep seeing. But this time of year, going into winter, they should mostly have nymphs on them, the small baby ones. And later in spring is when you'll start to see them really covered with the adult ticks and showing decay on their hide and all of the fur. So
even the ones that only had a few ticks today, had they lived, they might have had a lot of ticks in March or April?
Yes, definitely. So, you know, some of the hunters were actually recapping stories of seeing, you know, animals this past winter in the dead of winter, and you could watch with binoculars ticks crawling all over them. But yes, they could have very few on them right now, and by the middle of winter, they could have quite a lot on them.
So then what do you get out of knowing how many ticks are on the moose at this time of year?
Yeah, I understand that in New Hampshire they've pioneered a way to extrapolate based on the number that are on them right now, how many we can expect to have on them later in the year. So that we take a sample now, and based on the formula, they can figure out what these moose are going to have on them later.
At the end of moose season this year, Fish and Wildlife verified what Jane Lazorchek was finding at her moose check station. The average tick count was about 16. That's quite a drop from last year, when the average count was above 27. Now remember, that's only a sampling, so that moose still probably had hundreds, if not thousands, of ticks over her whole body. And biologists are checking at a time of year when moose typically have fewer ticks. Nonetheless, it's an encouraging sign. Having some snowpack late into the season can help kill ticks off, which might help explain the significant drop between last year and this year, because there was snow late in the season this past winter. The Fish and Wildlife Department has only been counting ticks for 2 years, so they still have to gather more information to have a better sense of how this all works. Tick check complete at the reporting station, Lazorchek moved on to one piece of data that all hunters really want to know. How much does the moose weigh? The hunters scrambled around the trailer bed, hooking up the moose to the weighing scale with some heavy chains. Then Lazorchek rows her up. Not the biggest moose of the year, which weighed in at 919 pounds dressed. But not the smallest, either. Jewel said he would butcher the moose when he got home and then keep the meat for winter. Meanwhile, all of the data collected by Lazorchek and her colleagues at reporting stations around the state will be tabulated and analyzed to give biologists a better understanding of the dynamics surrounding Vermont's moose herd. And it will help Fish and Wildlife determine how many moose permits to award next year.
That was VPR's Jane Lindholm reporting. Governor Peter Shumlin will be Bob Kinzel's guest tomorrow on Vermont Edition. Of course, the subject will be the very close general election vote and how that vote may have changed the governor's priorities and approach to governing. Email your comments for Governor Shumlin to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us at noon. Our program's produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Ayla Yersel. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Steve Zind. Thanks for listening.